G'day, and thanks for joining us for this week's Two Ticks Town Talk, a segment of the Australia Talks podcast. I'm DK.
And I'm RD.
Please enjoy this segment from the regular podcast.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, fair man. I've breathed the mountains.
All right. This week, over the past 18 months where we've been doing the Two Ticks Town Talks on numerous towns that have started and grew, and in many cases declined, due to the discovery of gold and natural resources. And often the history starts 100 to 200 years ago, and we can present a full story. But this week, I thought it would be interesting to present the story of a town that is in the middle of a modern growth spurt related to resources. So today we travel to Karratha in Western Australia. Now it's located approximately 1,535 kilometres, 954 miles in the old money, north of Perth. So it's right up the top west of Australia. It's at the south central end of Nicoll Bay, and that area's had little settlements on the bay since the 1860s. Now, Karratha was established in 1968 and gazetted in 1969, and it's named after the cattle station that was used as land for the town. In the local Aboriginal language, Karratha means good country or soft earth. So the local Aboriginal population up there are the Ngalluma people. But there's also throughout that region the Yinanbadi, Yaburara, Murihanera, and Wungu Tutaoa people who've lived in that area and the surrounding area for about 50,000 years. So, look, while I'll be emphasizing the impact of resources on the birth and growth of Karratha, let's just have a quick look around the land around Karratha that was occupied by those people, because it's interesting. There's it's an archipelago up there of about 50 islands, the Dampier Archipelago, named after the explorer Dampier, and the island on which the town of Dampier, that's just a small town up there, it's got artificially joined to the mainland. So it's essentially an artificial archipelago. So that island, Dampier Island, but you know, called Murujuga by the local people, that now that it's joined is now called the Burrup Peninsula. Murujuga actually means hip bones sticking out in the Yaburara language of up there. But the Dampier Rock Art Precinct, which covers that entire archipelago, it's a subject of ongoing political debate due to you know, proposed industrial development. But over 40% of Murujuga, which lies within the Murujuga National Park, contains within it the world's largest collection of ancient 40,000-year-old rock art petroglyphs. So it's just an absolute treasure trove. So when you look at it on the map, you can see that there's obviously an archipelago. There's going to be a whole lot of islands, but because it's connected to such rich ground and it's an area conducive to supporting life well, it's no surprise that there's been a rich history there. And these rock art petroglyphs are one of the world's great collections and one of the most prolific ones there. Now, a petroglyph, just in case you're wondering, it's an image created by removing part of a rock surface by either, you know, incising, picking or carving as a form of art. So in scholarly terms, a petroglyph is a rock engraving, whereas a petrograph is a rock painting. So I've dated some of those to more than 45,000 years old. There's also collections of standing stones, which is often a ceremonial or spiritual placing of stones by Aboriginal people, and that's some of the largest collections in Australia. And much of the rock art, or much of the rock art, many of the bits of the rock art, and there's about over a million of them, which is of the, these wow. petroglyphs. Yeah. Yeah, wow. exactly. That's right. Wow. So that sort of emphasizes why it's such a large and important collection. But a number of these petroglyphs depict images of the now extinct thylacine, like the Tasmanian tiger.
Oh.
So, yeah. Yeah, that's so the it is. I thought that was very interesting. So, yeah, the Deputy Rock Art Precinct covers the entire archipelago. Also, too, on July 2020, scientists published a study reporting on the finding of Australia's first ever ancient Aboriginal underwater archaeological sites at two sites off the Burrup Peninsula. So they found about 269 artifacts as well as an old underwater spring at Flying Foam Passage off Dampier. And described in the study, they're estimated to be thousands of years old, and the artifacts include hundreds of stone tools like grinding stones and evidence of life before sea levels rose between 7,000 and 18,000 years ago after the last ice age. So it's a highly significant area. So look, there's... Yeah, it bumps up against the resources that we'll be talking about. So it's concerned around the ecological, historical, cultural, and archaeological significance of the area. So there's campaigns for its protection. So that's been going on for since 1969 that there's been full on action, which coincides with a lot of the resource booms calling for preservation. Around there. So it's still an ongoing campaign to preserve what's up there. The resource side of the town that caught my interest was the Karratha itself came into being 1968. So it's 56 years ago, which in terms of what we've talked about with the history of Two Ticks Town Talks, when we say, oh, yeah, 1867, there was a gold boom, or so-and-so discovered lead down in this area, or there was the oil shale, they've got the 18s in front of it. It's interesting to hear one that's recent. So it started due to the tremendous growth of the iron ore industry and the need for a new regional centre caused by the shortage of land in Dampier. So basically Dampier was built on the island, which became the artificial archipelago, didn't have anywhere to go. It was originally established as a support town for the nearby Hemersley iron mining operations, but it's now become the central administrative service and supply hub for the entire Pilbara region. So I just want to go in a couple of the resource areas that have built this boom town, just to give it some context for its actual growth. So the first one was the iron ore boom. This is from the Journal of Australasian Mining History. The essay is, I'll put a link to this, but the establishment of iron ore giants Hemersley Iron and the Mount Newman Mining Company. And this is by a Professor David Lee. Between 1938 and 1960, the Australian government prohibited export of iron ore because of its belief that Australia's limited accessible reserves of iron ore had to be reserved for the Broken Hill Proprietary Company and the Australian steel industry. After the Commonwealth hesitantly relaxed the embargo in November 1960 to encourage exploration, independent Australian prospectors Lang Hancock and Stan Hilditch revealed that they had already discovered huge deposits of iron ore in the Pilbara in Western Australia. Can't you just imagine? They were just waiting for that embargo to stop. The success of the two largest iron ore companies, Hamersley Iron and the Mount Newman Company, was based on their signing long-term contracts with the Japanese steel industry, which permitted them to obtain the considerable foreign capital needed to finance the infrastructure for mines located hundreds of kilometres from the coast. And on the embargo, I thought it was interesting to read a bit of that excerpt from the same essay. That's a long one for people who are interested. Expert on the BHP from the article. The embargo of iron ore from 1938 to 1960 was a period of steady growth in the Australian steel industry and of BHP. So much so that BHP's management became strongly wedded to the maintenance of the export ban well after the Pacific War had ended. In 1960, BHP was still advising the Menzies government not to lift the embargo. Between the First and Second World Wars, BHP had built up an industry which used Australian ore to produce iron and steel products at low cost. Their virtual monopoly of the iron and steel industry was based on mining solid hematite hills in South Australia's Middleback Ranges. So basically, they said, we've got ours. We don't want anybody else in here.
Don't want to share the pie.
Yeah, that's right. And nowadays, iron ore is a vital commodity for WA with $5 billion of royalties and 50,000 employees as of 2018. So, look, while iron ore is currently not in a boom time, it is a product that's in steady demand. And Karratha, it's continuing to grow in conjunction with it. The second one, which is a big one up there, is salt mining. So, starting in 1967, the Dampier Salt Projects in WA, it's got three solar salt operations at Dampier, Port Hedland, and Lake McLeod. So, Dampier is the one up there near Karratha. The project is the world's largest exporter of seaborne salt, with capacity to produce approximately 10.3 million tonnes every year. Salt is one of the most widely used substances on Earth, with over 10,000 direct and indirect uses, a large and mature market, and I'm going to ask you to guess here. How many million tons per annum of salt do you reckon are consumed globally? So million tons per annum.
I don't know. I'd imagine it's a lot, but I don't know. Oh, a million tons. I'd say, 300 million.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So, 335. Wow. Well done. Might have pulled it out of your ass, but you were bloody close.
Yeah, that was a good guess, yeah.
So, yeah, that's a shirtload of salt. There's also a proposed new development called the Mardy Salt and Potash Project. It's meant to be getting production in the next few years, and sulfate of potash is a premium fertilizer containing essential nutrients, potassium and sulfur for plant growth, and it accounts for approximately 10% of the global potash market of 70 million tonnes per annum. So that also bodes well for Karratha and the surrounding regions. And finally, and this one you've probably heard of, the salt one was new to me, but the Northwest Shelf Project, the gas project. So in 1971, the North Rankin gas field was discovered in the Carnarvon Basin in water 125 metres deep, 135 k's off the coast of the port of Dampier. That discovery was followed in 72 by additional major discoveries of gas and condensate in the nearby Goodwin and Angel fields. The discoveries were technically challenging, and commercialization solutions required huge levels of investment for that day. There just hadn't been that need to throw that much money at something before. So it was a world-scale development that did prove to be financially viable. So the project required the production of liquefied natural gas for delivery to export markets. It would be the first liquid natural gas project in Australia and also represent the forerunner of a major new industry and significant contributor to the economy of Australia. During its construction phase in the 80s, it was the largest engineering project underway worldwide in the oil and gas industry, and today remains underpinned by vast hydrocarbon reserves, with activities going on to extend the life of the project. So once again, Karratha, the boom town, its position for further growth. So Karratha's moved from a mining support town based on fairly rudimentary accommodation to what is now technically a city. I think it's over 20,000. You can call yourself a city based on population. It's interesting to see that, and we've observed this with gold rush towns in the past, where you've got the initial gold rush, you set up the tents, and then you start to get the families come in, you start to get the structure in there, and suddenly it turns from temporary accommodation to, look, we want something a little bit more permanent, we want to raise families here, and it becomes a place where people actually want to live aside from what's going on with the resources that have supported them. So the same thing's happening in Karratha. People are wanting to raise family. The temporary dongas and accommodation they used to put up are no longer encouraged. In fact, I don't think they can do it anymore. Now, if you're wanting to use that as your base for your staff for the mines and the salts and the offshore rigs, you have to erect permanent structures. So if you look online and see the pictures of Karratha, you're seeing apartment buildings. You're actually seeing the typical infrastructure that you need to build communities. So, look, who knows what future commentators will say about Karratha in another 150 years? You know, will it be a major city, or will it be a bygone ghost town? Who knows? But right now, this Two Ticks Town Talk has given us a real-time glimpse into a current-day boom town.
That's cool because, yeah, like you said, so many times, you know, we see these boom and busts. The gold rush comes, The town builds up, gold rush ends, you know, towns left behind all over the country. But it's rare to see it like in its heyday, you know, which I feel like Karratha still very much is. And I hope it is going to continue to grow. See it to be seen, but that salt mine, the evaporation ponds, is pretty cool from the air. I'd imagine being there on the ground, it probably doesn't look like a lot, but from the air, it's very pretty. It's sort of
it is pretty
green, and then it sort of turns white as the water evaporates. I'm curious how much water they must use to get, because salt water is salty, but it's not that salty, or seawater, I should say. I assume they're using seawater, unless maybe they've got like
They are using. My understanding is, yes, they're using seawater.
Yeah, because there's only like, I think the ocean water on average is something like 3% salt or something. It's a very, very low amount. And so they must use a lot of water to supply the salt, I guess.
Yeah, well, you made that observation of how large it is. So you bring in some water, flood it, let it evaporate, bring in some more water, flood it, evaporate, until you're building up a large collection of salt within each of the different containment areas. So I don't think it's a case of, you know, flood the area, then mine the salt, and I'm happy to be corrected on this, but my understanding is that you're keeping on adding to an area until basically you can get your machinery in there and move huge piles of it.
Yeah, I would think they would pump. It's probably different stages. Again, I don't really know how they do this, but I'd imagine they sort of probably pump, you know, the first pool is basically seawater, the next pool is more concentrated salty seawater, and then the next pool, and so on and so forth. And then by the end, it's super concentrated, super saline water that sort of evaporates into nothing. And they can, yeah, like you said, get the machinery and a couple of diggers and things like that. They must have a big, now that I say that, thinking about that, they must have a real issue with corrosion in there. I was
just thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
I've seen the pictures. You've got literally mountains of salt higher than the big diggers and that.
I wonder
whether it's specialized equipment or whether they just say, listen, our lifetime is 1/10.
Yeah. I mean, there's certain things. Having been a sailor, I do know a little bit about corrosion control. Mm. Obviously, steel ships and ocean water don't go along very well. But it's just like a constant battle against corrosion. But this is like super saline water and literally mountains of salt. so I'd imagine they would have a real hard time. I'm kind of curious as to how they deal with that. If anyone's listening that just happens to know, please, please tell me. Please get in touch. I'd love to know how they deal with it. If it is just a case of, we expect them to burn out pretty quickly and rust is an issue and we just deal with it as it comes. Or is it, you know, do they use heavy duty, I don't know, like reinforced plastics or something like that instead, or some sort of alloy. I don't know. I'd be very curious. But I do hope Karratha, like I said, sort of doesn't bust, if you know what I mean.
Well, it's got three irons in the fire. I mean, all of those resource ones, and that's particularly why I concentrated on those, are growing.
And I don't think iron ore is going to go anywhere anytime soon. It's not like a gold rush. Like, the iron ore deposits are very substantial. There's a nice big modern airport there as well. So they're investing in the infrastructure. So the companies obviously expect things to not just dry up anytime soon. So, you know, hopefully Karratha is still there in 100 years. We're still talking about it. So there is a nice big long runway there, I've noticed. So, you know, maybe that could be a forward staging area for some F-35s in the future.
Oh, well, maybe. And look, they are promoting the tourism as well, because the countryside around there, you know, there's gorges, there's tracks. Spectacular countryside up there. You know, as you're not that far from the coast, you've got those that archipelago with all those islands. You've got a huge variety of different environments to explore in not a particularly big area. I know I'm saying not a particularly big area in terms of Australia. So I mean, I suppose, like I'm drawing about, you know, like 1,000 kilometer by 1,000 kilometer square around Karratha and thinking, well, that's all very, very doable. So if that's, let me get that qualifier. Within the distances we're used to, there's a hell of a lot to see around there.
I know what you mean. It's densely packed with things to do within a, 5-hour drive. If you're listening to this from Europe, shocked you're going to be at the size of all of this. I'm just really surprised people have lived here for 50,000 years, just because it appears so barren when you look at it. It's all sort of red dirt, and again, like, I understand there are trees, and if you go into street view, or even if you zoom in a little bit, you can clearly see that there is greenery in that. It just seems such an inhospitable place for life, but people have been living here for 50,000 years. So clearly, it is very hospitable to life. Maybe it's just the red dirt kind of throws me a little bit.
But I'm
curious where they get their water from, though. Because it does seem like quite a dry area.
Good point.
There are rivers around it, but they don't look like they're flowing. So there's a dam a little ways away from the town, but maybe that's their main water source.
Maybe
it could be part of like a bore or something like that. So,
and they might store a lot of water from, because you know it's up sort of tropical end of the Australia, so you know maybe they get enough rainfall to actually store water for the rest of the year. But good point. Don't know the answer to that,
because the golf club doesn't look very green when you look at it. the greens are green, but the rest of the fairways are a bit parched. Though again, we're looking at Google images. I don't know how old they are, the satellite photos and things like that. So, hey, look, they could have had lots of rain. I don't know.